Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we're looking at Christmas music and speaking with guitarist Peter Curtis. For the past couple of years, he's been noting and compiling Christmas songs which were written or co-written by Jewish songwriters. The phenomenon is explored and demonstrated quite nicely with his recent CD release of solo guitar work, Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend, Christmas music by Jewish songwriters. How long was it in the making? And I suppose what got this project going, whether it was personal research or leftover dissertation material, names or even types of names that you just kept on noticing?
Well, I guess what got the project started, the first Christmas/Hanukkah that my significant other Sophie and I spent together, I wrote her the song Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend as my Christmas present to her. So I had that song. And I can't remember, it was around the same time, maybe a year before, maybe after, I was doing a concert with the Temecula Master Chorale. They were doing a Christmas concert and they were doing a couple of pieces for choir with classical guitar accompaniment, and they had hired me to play the guitar part. And the conductor asked me if I wanted to do a solo on the concert, and I said yes. And at first I thought, well, maybe I'll do a Hanukkah song, you know, because I felt a little weird about doing a Christmas song on a Christmas concert because I'm Jewish. Then I thought, no, that's really obnoxious. It's a Christmas concert. It's in a church. You know, it would be kind of weird to just get up there and play a Hanukkah song. So I thought, I know, I'll do a Christmas song written by a Jewish person. So, first thing that pops to mind is Irving Berlin's White Christmas. And then I decided to make it a medley. Even before that, I was playing a gig out in Cathedral City at a place called AJ's, and the great jazz singer Diane Schur sat in with us on one song. I think she either winters out there or has a place there or was spending time there. She sat in and sang the Christmas song by Mel Torme. And so that song was in my head, and I knew Mel Torme was Jewish. And so I decided to do a medley of those two songs. So at that point, I've got three songs. And I just started to think, oh, okay, this could be a record. And I started working on the record in earnest in fall of 2018, my hope being that I could get it out in time for Christmas of 2018. And I recorded the record at home. And for the electric guitar stuff, I think it came out well enough just using my home system. But for the stuff where I was playing classical guitar, I didn't have good enough mics. I didn't have good enough preamps. The guitar just didn't sound like I think a guitar can sound when recorded professionally. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, I didn't really have enough time to promote it properly. By the time it was done, it was already like beginning of November, and I hadn't even gotten any artwork or anything done. So I thought, all right, I'm just going to have to sit on it and put it out the following year. So that's what I did. So it was really finished mainly in late 18 and then just sort of sat in the can for a year until it was time to put out.
Okay. So at some point then, when you were coming up with the rest of the songs, you had this one that became two and then three that you had this medley. So at some point then, you were trying to find other songs. Okay, what else? There's three songs. Three songs does not a CD make. So you had to come up with other songs that were also Christmas songs or seasonal songs written by Jewish writers, whether it's the song or the melody or both. What were some of the first ones, I guess, maybe that you noticed? Or what was something that maybe surprised you as far as, one, like, my gosh, how many there are? Or two, maybe songs that you didn't realize were written by Jewish writers or something like that, that was like, oh, whoa, okay, have to include this one.
Well, I wasn't actually surprised by how many there were because I had heard that a lot of Christmas songs had been written by Jewish composers. I should say Jewish songwriters, because it is not the case that on every song the music was written by a Jewish person. Some of them, it's the lyrics, a non-Jewish person wrote the music. Some, both music and lyrics were written by a Jewish person, and vice versa. Some were, the music was written by a Jewish person. So I just say Jewish songwriters. Anyway, so I knew that in general that a lot of Christmas songs had been written by Jewish songwriters, especially Christmas songs written in that period that we have come to call the Great American Songbook, or Tin Pan Alley, basically the period from roughly 1920 till about rock and roll hits. The Tin Pan Alley era songbook has a disproportionate number of songs written by Jewish songwriters.
So looking at this time around the turn of the century, when I think I heard this from you, looking at the association of folks who, in essence, were not welcome in mainstream society, and this includes both the Jews and folks in the entertainment industry. Is this an accurate reflection of what I heard at the lecture?
To an extent. I mean, I think entertainers were accepted, but I don't think they had, in the early 20th century, the kind of quasi royal status with which they're afforded now. I think there was still something of a 19th century notion of people in show business as doing something somewhat grubby. It wasn't like being a lawyer or a doctor or a respectable businessman. Now, you know, entertainers are treated like royalty practically.
Yeah.
But I don't think there was that same association. So I don't think that the prejudices that kept Jewish people out of universities, or that led to quotas at universities, that led to Jewish people not being able to enter certain professions or go to certain country clubs or golf clubs, I don't think that was present in show business, certainly not in songwriting. It was wide open. So between the 1880s and the 1920s, there's a huge amount of Jewish immigration to the New World. Most people that came to the United States ended up in New York City. Or if you were like my grandparents and you couldn't end up in the land of opportunity, you went to the land next door to the land of opportunity and ended up in Montreal.
Yeah, there we go. Okay.
Which was the next port in the nearest country where you could get in.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, Montreal did not have a burgeoning music publishing, songwriting business, but New York did in the early 20th century. That period between the 1880s and the 1920s corresponds with the rise of the music publishing industry in New York City, with vaudeville being a huge force. Tin Pan Alley gets its name from this area where most of the publishing houses were based in New York City. And so the sound of pianos being played simultaneously in different buildings along that street sounded to some passersby, apparently, like tin pans being slammed together, and thus the name Tin Pan Alley. So you have people in these buildings writing songs. You also had song pluggers who would have vaudeville performers come to their offices, and these song pluggers would try to get songs placed in Broadway shows or vaudeville shows. First vaudeville, then Broadway, and eventually in movies. And this period where this is really a prominent rising phenomenon is the period where you've got a lot of Jewish people arriving in New York City, and the two collide. Furthermore, like I said, Jews were excluded from certain professions. There were quotas at universities, but Tin Pan Alley was wide open, and Jews really succeeded. The other thing about it that I personally believe strongly is that the phenomenon of Jewish assimilation in 20th century America has a musical representation in what comes to be known as the Great American Songbook.
Mm-hmm.
This group of Jewish people who are assimilating into American society are writing this music that comes to be so associated with the country that they are trying to assimilate into that they have essentially created a big part of what we consider to be the sound of the country.
Nice.
And I think it's not just limited to popular music. I think in classical music, you find the same phenomenon where you've got Aaron Copland, for instance, a Jewish guy from Brooklyn, writing things like Appalachian Spring and Billy the Kid and Rodeo.
Yes.
And these pieces with overtly American themes. Now, that's not to say that there are not non-Jewish composers who are overtly influenced and overtly used influences from Americana. But I can't think of many other examples of composers who are so at pains to demonstrate their Americanness as Aaron Copland, this Jewish guy from Brooklyn. So I see the phenomenon of Jews writing Christmas music as one aspect of this larger phenomenon of Jews writing American popular music in the early 20th century. And they were trying to write American music. And Christmas songs were part of that because in this period, Christmas is largely an American holiday. You know, obviously it's a Christian holiday, and for Christian people, it's celebrated religiously. But the holiday, especially in an increasingly commercial society, a society with radio and later television and film, Christmas becomes something that, even though it is a Christian holiday, transcends Christianity and becomes sort of an American holiday. And many of the trappings that we associate with Christmas are appropriations from non-Christian traditions anyway, like the pagan Christmas tree.
Oh, December 25 right there. It's an adaptation as well. Yeah, of course.
Right. And I think that the story of Santa Claus actually comes from a Germanic myth.
Germanic, Norwegian, something like that.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, totally.
So what's interesting about these songs is that none of these songs are religious. None of the songs on my album are religious. And for the most part, none of the Christmas songs written by Jewish people are religious. They're all about the season, mistletoe, reindeer, but you don't hear Jesus mentioned or three wise men or virgins. That's not in these songs. The only counterexample I can think of a Christmas song written by a Jewish person that has a quasi-religious theme is Do You Hear What I Hear?
Oh, yeah.
Which has that, a child. But other than that one, all of the Christmas songs by Jewish people that I know of are not religious, and certainly none of the ones on my record are. They're all about the season and its secular trappings.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Peter Curtis. His CD, Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend, came out just about this time last year and is perfect for this year as well. More at petercurtismusic.com.
We'll come back to the CD in just a little bit, but let's talk just a bit about your early training. I read Berkeley, Yale, and then Indiana University, Bloomington, we mentioned. Bloomington, Indiana, that's actually huge in some circles if you're going up there for the Keynesian human sexuality studies or music or library science work.
Yeah,
people will end up in Bloomington.
I used to hang out around the Kinsey Institute trying to meet girls, but...
If you're going to go meet somebody for that purpose, go to the Kinsey Institute. But Berkeley was your undergraduate.
Yep.
And then Yale for your master's work. And then your PhD was at Indiana University. But before any of your formal training, when did you actually start on the guitar or musical training of any kind? Maybe it was the piano at 3 before you picked up 6 strings. And
frankly, I wish it had been. But, you know, my parents didn't push music at all. So I didn't have lessons from an early age. Nobody suggested music lessons. My dad sang. He had a beautiful voice and could really croon and liked doing sort of Sinatra-esque repertoire around the house. And, you know, occasionally would get up in a piano bar and belt one out.
Nice.
And had a great voice. And his sister, my Aunt Bobby, married a musician who later became my mentor, the great jazz bass player, Bob Cranshaw.
Oh.
Yeah, when I tell people that Bob's my uncle, some people, you know, raise an eyebrow because they wonder how this African-American man can be my uncle. But
right.
He is my uncle because he married my father's sister. That, you know, he's my uncle. So, yeah, he was an important mentor, but they were in New York. We were in Montreal. I didn't have much contact with them as a kid. I got into guitar because I wanted to. My dad had played for a time briefly when I was a kid, and I have fond memories of him taking the guitar out and me wanting to touch it and play with it, and him saying, no, I have to practice, and sort of shooing me away. But I think two things happened that started to get me into it, which was, one, I had a friend at school who was learning to play the guitar, and that sort of inspired me. The other thing that happened was when I was... Well, I'm giving away my age here, but when I was 10, John Lennon was murdered. Oh. And in response to that, the radio stations started playing tons of Beatles music all the time. And I just really loved it. So even though I'm, you know, a half generation or maybe even a generation removed from the legion of people who saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and decided they wanted to play guitar, for me, it was Beatles music, or a generation and a half later, after the death of John Lennon, that got me thinking, I want to play the guitar. So we had a guitar in the house, and I started picking it up and messing around with it. And the friend of mine at school that was already playing had a teacher, and I asked for her phone number. And sure enough, she lived directly across from the back lane of our house. so I could walk across the backyard and go have my lesson with her once a week.
Excellent.
So yeah, that was my start. And in high school, I played in bands and I wrote songs and sang and played the guitar in bands. And, you know, my uncle was this great jazz bass player. But as this Jewish Canadian, I didn't have a sense that what he did was something I could do. I was completely in awe of him playing jazz. The first time I ever heard jazz live was hearing my uncle play with Sonny Rollins at the Montreal Jazz Festival.
Oh, wow. In person.
Yeah.
So not like just, you picked up a Lee Morgan record and found him there or whatever. That's another Bob Cranshaw thing. But
it is indeed. That's the archetypal Bob Cranshaw bass line. But the first time I'd ever heard jazz performed live was hearing Sonny Rollins. I mean, can you imagine?
Wow.
The first jazz you've ever heard is Sonny Rollins. My uncle's playing bass. Just completely blew my mind. It never occurred to me that that was something I could do. And also, I still kind of wanted to get my rock and roll ya-ya's out. I was like 12. And so I played in rock bands in high school. But then towards the end of high school, I started dating this woman who was singing some jazz, and she sort of insisted that I accompany her. So I had to learn how to play some jazz chords. Then towards the end of high school, I had fully intended on making it in my rock band, and that's what I thought I would do. I hadn't really given much thought to studying music in college, but you know, I applied to go to the university in Vancouver where we were living, and that was an option. I got in there, and I asked my uncle, you know, if I'm thinking of studying music, where do you think I ought to go? And he said the Berklee College of Music, which I applied, I got in, and I thought, oh, I guess I'm going. So that was that.
Two of my friends and folks that have been on the show in the past and that I really, really hope people in this listening area know of, Sean Longstreet and Eva Mikhailovna and Eva and the Vagabond Tales. Both Eva and Sean are both former students of yours. We get to hear Sean's music at least once a week on my show. He opens and closes the music most of the time. And you've been a listener for some time. And so these are a couple of folks in this area. The fact that you have had students go on to become a success at one level or another.
I'd love to talk about that. In February, it'll be 19 years that I've been teaching at RCC. And there's a Yiddish word, which is kvelling. To kvell is to feel pridefully, typically about one's offspring, but it doesn't have to be one's offspring, though it usually is. It's like, oh, when Mitchell was doing his bar mitzvah, you should have seen his parents kvelling. You know, okay. That would be like a use of kvelling. So basically, what I was going to say is every time I hear Sean's music on your show, which I hear practically every week, I kvell. It just makes me feel this kind of quasi-parental pride and joy for his success. And pride is really the wrong word because it's his success. It's not my success. But I'm just grateful that somebody that I got to work with is doing so well. And I guess it's very similar to the way a parent would feel pride in his or her children's accomplishments. Not that Sean is my kid. The only kids I have are canine and feline, but I can imagine it's a similar thing. You know, if somebody's son or daughter achieves something, you feel this certain parental pride. So, yeah, I feel immense pride in what Sean has accomplished, and I'm really happy for him. And every time I hear his music on your show, I sort of think, go, Sean. And yeah, it's wonderful. And he was a remarkable student at RCC. I first met him actually when he was still in high school. RCC has a jazz festival every year, and all these local high school jazz bands come there. And I was giving a masterclass for guitarists, and Sean was the only guitarist that year who actually got up and played for me and to get my constructive criticism when he was still in high school. And I gave it to him. And the next year he came to RCC and was studying guitar with me. And he was the kind of student who just, I remember the first lesson, he was talking to me about having heard artificial harmonics on a Lenny Bro album. And I said, well, do you want to know how to do artificial harmonics? And I showed him just the basics of how to do artificial harmonics, like so.
There it is.
Which Lenny Bro does a lot. And the next week, he came back with an entire arrangement of the song Gentle Rain using artificial harmonics. He was that kind of student. You'd just give him a little kernel, and he'd run with it.
Wow.
So he was a, yeah, remarkable guy, and is a remarkable guy, and it was a joy to work with him.
For whatever it's worth, he speaks of you quite highly in that you were very influential in ways and that he described you as I believe the word was incredible, not only academic, but also player. And he has learned from you. And I don't have anything more specific, unfortunately, but you do receive credit from him as well and from Eva as well. I believe you were her jazz improv instructor. This is Eva and the Vagabond Tales there.
Yeah, she took a jazz improvisation class with me. That's interesting because my recollection of her in that class was that she was a bit shy. And I don't know if it was because she was one of the only singers or if it was because she was one of the only women or if it had nothing to do with that. But it struck me as kind of odd because after I had her in that class, I saw her perform with her own group, Yvonne the Vagabond Tales, and she was anything but shy.
Yeah.
So it was sort of interesting to me to look back and think of her as this shy student and now this really dynamic, charismatic performer.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's incredible. Anytime you see either Eva or Sean play, it would be hard to imagine them as someone new, as someone trying to just open up the mic for the first time or whatever the case may be. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back now to guitarist Peter Curtis and his recent release, Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend, solo guitar arrangements of Christmas music by Jewish songwriters.
I don't go to church, but then nor do you. On Christmas Day, I like to eat mooshu. You'll drive those girls on J-Date straight around the bend when you spend Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend. Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend. My people wrote so many Christmas songs. So come on, baby, we can get along. The foes of intermarriage you will surely offend when you spend Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend. Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend. You've got 12 days, I've got 8 nights. I light the menorah, you have Christmas lights. Let's share our traditions and not have a fight. Who cares who's wrong if our love is right? Now mistletoe and eggnog are just fine. With dreidels and with gelt they intertwine. Interfaith dialogue is surely on the mend. Besides, it's one less Christmas card that you'll have to send. As long as we are living, let's hope there is no end to Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend. Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend.
Well, going into the CD, we'll be looking at Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend. You mentioned this was initially a very special present for your girlfriend, the Gentile, Sophie.
Sophie,
okay.
Yeah. The Gentile.
I may keep that in. Did she have any idea that this was coming? Or was it like, okay, you light the tree, I'll be lighting the fourth candle, then sit down, I've got a song for you. How did this come about for her?
She didn't know that I was going to do it. I mean, we hadn't even really been together that long. We'd only been together for a few months. We went to her parents' house for Christmas, and I recorded a little demo version of it and gave it to her Christmas morning.
Oh, so you gave her a recording. You didn't
I played the recording for her on Christmas morning.
That's fantastic. Well, looking at Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend, these songs, if a person just glances across the back of it, it's a surprising number of songs that were written by Jews that ended up being Christmas songs. But as we mentioned, they're not so much about the baby Jesus or the Christ child, but songs written by Jewish songwriters, and this could be the words or the melody or both. One that I want to hit first, I suppose, Santa Baby. I learned this at your lecture slash performance. One, I had no idea that this was actually written for Eartha Kitt.
Yep.
So I'm curious if the background of it, the writers were actually tasked with writing a Christmas song that was sexy.
Well, I don't know if they necessarily were told that they had to write a Christmas song that was sexy, but they were asked to write a song for Eartha Kitt. And she was already a well-known performer, well-known for being this ribald, sexy performer. Yeah. So how do you write a Christmas song for someone like that? And it was Philip Springer and Joan Javits. Philip Springer was born in 1926. He wrote a lot of music for TV. He actually wrote the music for Gunsmoke, as well as for a show called Mannix and a show called Medical Center. He had some other hits like How Little It Matters, which Sinatra recorded. And his co-writing partner with that was Joan Javits, who interestingly was the niece of Jacob Javits, the senator from New York. And I didn't recognize any of her other songs. One of them is called That's How the Yodel Was Born. I really should hear that because it sounds really interesting. But yeah, they were hired to write this song for Eartha Kitt, and Santa Baby was what they came up with. It's pretty ingenious.
That's truly incredible. And was she already Catwoman at this point, or was she just I Want to Be Evil, some of the songs that she was known for before she ended up on TV?
I think it was before. Santa Baby was recorded in 1953. I think at that point she was largely known as a stage performer.
Okay. Another one that we have here on your CD, I'll Be Home for Christmas. For most folks out there, this is just quite simply a beautiful song about coming home for the holidays. But looking at it from a Jewish songwriter's perspective, there is a much more poignant origin on this. Can you please share this one with us?
Sure. Well, the song was written by Walter Kent, who was born Walter Maurice Kaufman. He wrote the music and he was Jewish. And the lyrics were written by James Kim Gannon, who was not Jewish. But the song was released in 1943, and it was obviously released during World War II, and it's sung from the perspective of a soldier at war who will be home for Christmas. And the tagline is, I'll be home for Christmas if only in my dreams. And when one considers the plight of Jews during the Holocaust and World War II, to me that gives the song an even greater poignancy, especially given who its writers were. I don't know if any of that was intended, but whether or not the authorial intent was there or the compositional intent was there, when you think of it in that context, that a song written from the perspective of a soldier in World War II, talking about that, being home for Christmas if only in my dreams, at the time when that historical calamity was befalling the Jews, it gains an additional poignance for me.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you. There were some of the songwriters that you spoke about at your performance and lecture at RCC at the Coyle Center. And one of the folks that you listed, I think it was Irving Berlin. Mm-hmm. Folks know him best probably with Blue Skies, I think, maybe. You put up a list of the other songs, the other particularly Christmas songs. And I think there were 10 or 12 or 15. I tried to count them, but the slideshow was gone quick.
I don't think the 10 or 12 or 15 Christmas songs were Irving Berlin. I did put up a list of famous Irving Berlin songs.
That may have been it.
And they're just unbelievably famous, iconic American songs. One of the great Tin Pan Alley songwriters said, "Irving Berlin has no place in American music. He is American music." And while that overstates the case, you know, when you think of the great American songbook, the list that you refer to, you know, you've got Blue Skies, Cheek to Cheek, Alexander's Ragtime Band, There's No Business Like Show Business, God Bless America, I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm, Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better. So these are really iconic American songs.
I guess me coming from a jazz perspective, I would have gone with Blue Skies, but I suppose probably more of the American public would think of God Bless America.
To me, Blue Skies is a really interesting case. It's interesting that you mentioned Blue Skies. First of all, Blue Skies is performed by Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer, the first talking big picture. Al Jolson himself Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But the bridge of Blue Skies, and this was pointed out to me by one of my professors, Jeffrey McGee, who was at Indiana University, is now at University of Illinois, I believe. But he's a music historian. And he pointed out that were he to write a song wherein the bridge is talking about... If you were writing that song, right, the lyrics are, "Never saw the sun shining so bright." He probably would have done that, right? "Never saw the sun shining so bright." But no, that's not what Irving Berlin does. It's... which really sounds like Jewish music.
Yeah.
Here, I'll do it in a different key. It might come out better.
Okay.
You know, when it's got that swinging rhythm, you don't hear it as much, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you play it like that, with that kind of rhythmic emphasis, instead of "never saw the sun shining so bright." It sounds really very much like an Eastern European Jewish melody. So it kind of creeps in places, that being one of them.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Peter Curtis. His latest release is called "Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend." You can find it through Amazon, CD Baby, and iTunes, as well as on streaming services. And you can find more at petercurtismusic.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 FM, streaming at kvcrnews.org.
I think the list that you were thinking of, where I listed the person who wrote just the huge number of Christmas songs, was Johnny Marks.
Yeah, okay, yes.
Yeah, Johnny Marks wrote "Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer."
That's the one.
And he basically made a career out of writing Christmas music. A lot of the Christmas songs that he wrote "A Holly Jolly Christmas."
He wrote
"Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree."
Yeah.
He wrote "Run, Rudolph, Run."
Oh, my gosh.
Well, there's some of these other ones that I haven't heard of, like "When Santa Claus Gets Your Letter."
Yeah, I don't know that one.
No, me neither.
Okay.
I heard "The Bells on Christmas Day."
Oh, I knew that one, yeah.
Though that one was co-written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Yeah, he actually started his own publishing company called St. Nicholas Music. Can I tell the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
I was going to ask you to tell that. I'll put out that I just learned that Rudolph was very close to being named Reginald or Rollo.
Hmm.
And so I was hoping you could tell us about Montgomery Ward, the coloring books, the thick fog in Chicago.
Robert L. May was a copywriter for Montgomery Ward. And Montgomery Ward was doing a special Christmas charitable event where they were giving away books to children in need. And they decided that rather than give away books that they had in stock, that they would task someone who worked for them, in this case, the copywriter Robert L. May, who happened to be Jewish, to write a small book for children. And Robert L. May created this fictional character, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And that's where that character first appears. Now, again, the Jewish background, I think, is important in that Rudolph is this character who is ostracized and excluded from the mainstream reindeer community because of his unusual nose. And I don't think it takes that much of a leap of imagination to see how that could be a metaphor for feeling excluded as a Jewish person or about the experiences of Jewish people. Furthermore, the booklet was written in 1939, the year Hitler invades Poland and World War II starts. So maybe it's just all coincidence, but I think that strains credulity. So Robert L. May writes the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in 1939. 10 years later, his brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, writes the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in 1949, and Gene Autry, the country singer, has a big hit with it. So there's just sort of, to me, layers of kind of the American melting pot in this story. These Jewish guys writing a story about, you know, this mythological Christmas character, which is then a hit for a country and Western singer. It really expresses a lot of the melting pot of this country.
A clash of vastly different cultures there that you would not expect to come together for something like this. A person can easily enough find a video presentation of Sleigh Ride, and on this and others, you really self-accompany with a walking bass line. And I'm very curious about how this can even be done, or if it ends up being too technical, I'm not sure, but some jazz guitarists will wrap their thumb around the neck to fret the low E. You don't. I just don't understand how it's done to even keep the bass line going and then to also include the melody. Because watching you on video performing Sleigh Ride, you don't get any clues on it. You just see you going back and forth between the bass line and then the melody. And I think that we're not necessarily hearing a bass line all the way through. We're getting the suggestion of it, and then we think it's still going on.
You are very shrewd.
That's it. Yeah. Okay.
It's not always there. It's often there, but there are times where one has to be judicious and cut it out a little bit. But I mean, I can't take credit. There are many, many great jazz guitarists who do that kind of thing. And classical guitar is all about using the guitar as an unaccompanied instrument, sort of a miniature orchestra, wherein, you know, one's thumb is playing bass lines and the fingers are playing both melody and accompaniment, and it all comes together. There are some jazz guitar players who play solo unaccompanied jazz guitar. Some of my musical heroes, like Joe Pass, Lenny Bro, Gene Bertoncini, these are all great jazz guitar players who play unaccompanied. And they will provide melody, harmony, and bass, sometimes all three at the same time. And so it's not something new to me, but that's something that inspired me about classical guitar, you know, when I studied it, trying to use the guitar's capabilities of being a contrapuntal, polyphonic instrument where you can play multiple lines of music at the same time. Most of the time in a jazz context, guitar players are either playing like a horn player, where we're playing single note lines, or we're used like sort of the left hand of a piano player, where we're playing chords. And in a band, those are typically your two functions, to either be the chord guy or to take a solo. When you play unaccompanied guitar, you have to kind of fill in all the parts, which is what a piano player would do playing solo. Yeah. And guitar is one of the few instruments that has the capability of being able to play contrapuntal. That means multiple part music. Organ, piano, guitar, that's about it. One thing that's interesting to me was even before I got into classical guitar, because I started with rock and roll and folk and rock and roll, then I got interested in jazz. And then my late uncle, who was a big musical mentor for me, suggested that I take some classical lessons with the idea that it would help my technique. And I did, and I fell in love with that repertoire. And for a long time, I studied classical guitar. But even before I was playing classical guitar, which is all about using the guitar as a polyphonic instrument where you're playing bass with a thumb and your fingers are playing melodies and chords, in high school, I got a recording of the blues singer Robert Johnson. And Robert Johnson would do this thing where he would play a bass line with his thumb. And on top, he'd do stuff like... I remember the summer between 11th and 12th grade, sitting down with my King of the Country Blues Singers record, it was a record, and trying to figure out how he was doing that. So that was, I think, my first taste of developing that independence between thumb and fingers that I use on the stuff that you're talking about on this record.
Okay.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. We are streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm speaking with Riverside guitarist Peter Curtis. We are talking about, among other things, his CD Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend, exploring the many, many traditional Christmas tunes written by Jewish songwriters. More to be found at petercurtismusic.com.
There was one song that you played at the lecture I attended, and it was a Christmas song using primarily harmonics.
Right. That was I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Okay, that was I'll Be Home for Christmas.
It wasn't the entire song, but just the first A section.
Yeah.
And I was using artificial harmonics. You know, you can play harmonics on the guitar if you put your finger right above the 12th fret on, say, the E string and just barely touch it. You can get that sort of bell-like sound. You can get it as well on the 5th fret. And the 7th fret. But if you put your finger, say, on the 1st fret, and then put one finger of your right hand on the 13th fret, 12 frets higher, and then pluck with a different finger, your left hand is holding down the note on the 1st fret, your index finger is just touching it 12 frets higher on the 13th fret, and your middle finger is plucking, you can get this effect. So you're getting a harmonic, and that's called an artificial harmonic.
Okay.
That leaves the thumb free to play other things. When I was a student, I learned this classical guitar piece called El Testamento d'Emilia, which many classical guitar students learn. It's got this beautiful middle section with artificial harmonics that goes... That's a little bit of El Testamento d'Emilia. So you're doing the artificial harmonics with two fingers, and then your thumb is plucking the lower notes to play a bass line. You know, well, look, piano players are doing all kinds of stuff. Organists are doing both hands and then their feet going, so it's not that big a deal.
True.
So I just thought it would be something about the "if only in my dreams" lyric in I'll Be Home for Christmas sort of seemed to suggest those artificial harmonics. They've got a bit of a dreamy, ethereal quality. So I think that was part of why I chose to start my arrangement of I'll Be Home for Christmas with those artificial harmonics.
Nice, nice. Earlier, we were speaking about any songs that might have surprised you if they came from a Jewish writer. And we ended up talking about a few other things, but I know that there are some in here that you spoke about before when I saw you in lecture.
Yeah, well, I was surprised and delighted to find out that Christmas Time Is Here has lyrics written by Lee Mendelssohn. Everybody who pays attention to Peanuts and is interested in music, and certainly jazz musicians, know that Vince Guaraldi wrote the Peanuts theme and did all the music for Peanuts, and that he wrote that beautiful melody for Christmas Time Is Here. What I didn't know until I started this project was that the lyrics for Christmas Time Is Here were written by Lee Mendelssohn, who was Jewish. And so I was psyched to find that, because, you know, all I need is one of them. The lyrics or music, and I'll record it. So that was, you know, that was good enough for me. So I was really happy. And Lee Mendelssohn is an interesting character. He's from California, went to Stanford, was a journalist, went on to become a documentarian, did a documentary about Willie Mays. And apparently, after doing a documentary about the person who was then the greatest baseball player in the world, he decided to do a documentary about the worst baseball player in the world, Charlie Brown. But the documentary was actually about Charles M. Schulz. And apparently, the story goes, you know, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but the story is that he was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge, heard something by Vince Guaraldi on the radio, and decided that Vince Guaraldi should be the person to score this documentary about Charles Schulz. And that led to when Coca-Cola wanted to do the first Peanuts special, Lee Mendelssohn, who was the producer, got Vince Guaraldi to write the music, including that famous Peanuts theme. So even though Lee Mendelssohn didn't write the music, he wrote the lyrics and he got Vince Guaraldi the gig. So that's all the more reason why I feel like I could include that. That was a surprise. What I will say also was, you know, sort of the reverse of that were disappointments, where there was a Christmas song that I really liked, and I was hoping that it was written by a Jewish person, but it wasn't. So, like, I'm wondering if I can, like, I've heard that there are certain religions that will posthumously convert people. I'm not going to name names, but I've heard that that is a phenomenon amongst certain religions. So that did occur to me, but I decided not to dabble in that. But have yourself a Merry Little Christmas. I really like that tune. And, you know, at first I'd heard that one of the writers was Jewish, but upon closer inspection, nope. So couldn't include that one.
Boo.
Yeah.
Boo.
Well, a Christmas song, the Christmas song, not a Christmas song, but the Christmas song. I believe Mel Torme has said that this is the song that got him a new car every single year. I believe so.
I haven't heard that quote, but I have heard him give advice to people who want to write songs that they should write Christmas songs because of what you just said. They're evergreen.
Yeah.
If you can get a hit, you know. Of course, that was back in an era where people made money from recorded music. I guess some people still make money from recorded music, but it's not like it used to be. I get 0.01 cents for every stream on Spotify. I actually spent a long time looking at my royalty check, like thinking, like, is that decimal in the right place? Do I need new glasses? What's going on here?
You got a check for less than a penny?
Well, no, but when it lists all the streams, you know, I'm looking at each individual stream and seeing like 0.01 cents. What?
You're paying in rupees.
Well, my take on that is I think there was basically a historically anomalous period of a little over 100 years where recorded music existed. Well, now we're going on 125 years. But there's this historically anomalous period where there is such a thing as recorded music. And during that historically anomalous period, there were probably, 75 years where people were making lots of money from recorded music. That period appears to have ended, and we seem to be going back to something like what it was like for musicians for most of the history of music, where people were not getting rich from recorded music. music. So when I felt bad about getting my 0.01 cent royalty, I made myself feel better by just thinking that, you know, well, that's better than people got 100 years ago. Now, actually, 100 years ago, people might have gotten royalties, but 150, no way, from recordings.
Wow. I'm hoping that we could close out with you playing a Christmas song that maybe you were considering for this CD, but it didn't make it.
Oh, wow.
That was phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
So I'd asked for a song that was not included, and what we got was a brand new arrangement. Bonus.
Thank you for encouraging me to do that. I've got something new in my repertoire.
Peter, I really, really appreciate you coming in for this. This has been an absolute pleasure, not just to devour these discs, but to be able to speak with you about Christmas with your Jewish boyfriend, and to know that in the near future, we'll be speaking about Swing State as well as some other works that you have for the near future. I really, really look forward to this. But again, I can't thank you enough for coming in for this.
Well, I can't thank you enough for giving me the exposure, having me out here, being so generous with your time. And it's really an interesting experience to hear a voice that I'm used to hearing on Wednesday nights when I'm chopping vegetables as I'm preparing dinner, to hear it over the telephone or face-to-face or now in the recording studio. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, it's really cool.
Thanks again.
I've been speaking with guitarist Peter Curtis. We've been speaking mainly about his CD for the season, Christmas with Your Jewish Boyfriend. It came out just a little over a year ago, and that's when we originally heard this interview. More at petercurtismusic.com, including his latest, Steel in Love. It's a fantastic CD featuring vocalist Ken Steele. We'll hopefully have Peter in the studio again to talk about that one. I have to point out, too, that that rendition of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Peter spent just a few minutes figuring out the arrangement, I mean, right before he started playing it. Really, couldn't have asked for more. Thanks again, Peter, and here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Andrew Caravella, Rick Dulock, and Sharina Wadd. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR, it's composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening, and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.